Good afternoon. This is WCBN FM Ann Arbor. You're listening to The Living Writers Show. My name is Ashley David, and my guest today is Roy Jacobstein, poet, public health physician, and we'll be talking about his book of poems, Ripe, which was a finalist for the American Academy of Poets Walt Whitman Award and the Ed Hirsch pick for the 2002 Felix Pollack Prize, as well as a whole host of other things. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's really great to have you here. This show has been pre-recorded for broadcast today, by the by. Well, let's begin with Manifest Destiny. You told me in an earlier conversation that you fulfilled your manifest destiny as the firstborn Jewish son, but this was not as a poet.
No, I found through life that many stereotypes and jokes have a certain aspect of truth in them. So when I tell people the joke that my parents sent out the birth of the announcement of their son, Dr. Roy Jacobstein, they were only partially kidding. So it was a sort of manifest destiny.
Great. But you became a physician, and you have been, well, let's see, we'll sort of circle back in there, but you became a physician and a public health, you have a master's in public health as well, and have worked in international development. But in that same conversation, you told me about always being a writer, even though this is not sort of your first profession.
Well, actually, a subsequent teacher of mine, when I lamented the fact that I had not actually been writing for a number of years before I did what I think of as breaking through to writing, told me I always was writing. I actually wasn't always writing, but I did always want to write. I thought it was a very high calling, on a par certainly with medicine even then, but I had what I thought of as primary terminal writer's block. I didn't think I would ever be able to write.
Well, you've clearly done it. Let's take a look at some of your poems. Let's start with the first poem from the book Ripe. Would you read Chartreuse for us?
Sure. I should mention, if I may, my mother was a French teacher, and that will emerge in the poem, but it's also there in the title, Chartreuse. The finches must be migrating north again. There, someone points, and at last I see it in the quivering backdrop of backlit leaves, and immediately I think of my mother, because it's the color she called chartreuse, looking up at me from her magnifying glass and sheaf of French exams, to affix that word to the 58 Chevy my father brought home. Everything was a forest then, impenetrable as the upper Amazon, our modern parents raising us beneath the icy aegis of science. It wasn't pee-pee and poop. It was urinate and defecate, penis and vagina, yet never a hint of the mechanics or mess of sex. So what else could I do but attend med school to learn left supraclavicular notch was the name for that soft indentation above the collarbone whence I'd thought for years babies must come, knowing even then they must come from somewhere deep within the woman's body. Yes, it was also abstruse, but now my dictionary yields memory's precise hue. It's a clear light green with a yellowish tinge, color of the aromatic liqueur made by the Carthusian monks at Grenoble, France. And you ease its top shoulder down and bottom shoulder up to guide it safely from the birth canal out into this numinous world of sun and finch, Amazon and oak, of stillness and motion, nest and migration, of source and shadow, instrument and accident, of holding on and letting go.
Beautiful, thank you. Let's talk a little bit about the ways in which you come to your writing. There are very different sorts of ways in which one comes to medicine. Everyone I know who's been through med school is memorizing, and there's a certain thing you are supposed to learn, whereas poetry is this broader sort of thing you are supposed to bring forth, and there are things to learn, but there's also an opening up that's involved. That is a very different, I imagine, process than what happens in medicine. Will you tell us a little bit about that process for you?
Well, that's true, and that's a very interesting question, and I actually haven't thought about that. I'm in a funny way, I'm almost the opposite point. I'm giving several presentations on the complementarities and interpenetration of poetry and medicine and what they have in common, a kind of way of seeing and a way of being in the world. So I hadn't thought about it the way you put it, but it's actually very interesting. In medicine, of course, one has to assimilate a huge amount of new facts, new materials, new ways of behaving, and you're assuming a profession. And in poetry, you're facing the empty page. We may get into this later, but that empty page had a certain paralyzing aspect early on, and it still does, I suspect, for many writers out there who may be listening to this. But it may be because of those differences that there are so many, historically and in our time, so many people in the health professions who also seek some creative outlet and are known for that, whether it's writing or another art form.
Great. So when you are writing, do you have to sort of carve out a space that's very different from the space that you have in your other, when you're wearing your other hats? And how do you go about it?
Well, I definitely have to carve out space. I have to have kind of a sense of time and space and not being... I have what a patient of mine once called a short attention plan. So I I'm easily distractible, and it's helpful to be in one's own space. On the other hand, just walking over here for the interview, I saw some things that triggered thoughts, and I took notes, and I suspect all writers have their pad, figuratively or not, where they jot little notes. And so I have a, much like some people keep their taxes in a folder and go to it once a year, I have a folder of little jottings, and I'll go to them. And so often when I go to write in the morning, I don't even know what I'm going to be writing about.
Is morning the time that you sort of carve out as the sacred time for writing, or do you plug in here and there throughout the day?
When I had a lot more time available, morning was the time, and it's still the preferable time because it's closest to dreams, so there's that duality of worlds that you can hopefully tap into.
Yeah. Well, you went to school after you've gotten your MD and your MPH, your Master's in Public Health. After establishing this career as an international development person and a physician, you went back to school again to get your Master's of Fine Arts and went to the Warren Wilson School, which is a low residency MFA program. Can you tell me about the decision to do that and how you went from jottings and writing sort of on your own to deciding to formalize this as part of the what you are?
Sure. When I finally broke through to writing, because I suspect of my medical training and medical background, I had very much an apprentice concept of learning. And in fact, in medical school, the first day I remember, they tell you that the doctor is a perpetual student, and I have certainly proven that because I actually came back to Ann Arbor after graduating medical school about 10 years after that to get my MPH, and then I got my Master's in Fine Arts about 10 years after that. So, and the Warren Wilson program is designed for people that have already families and lives and careers, and it's a very interesting pedagogical approach where it has no permanent faculty. I was fortunate enough to study with wonderful teachers, including my last teacher, who is a professor here in Ann Arbor, Linda Gregerson. And the pedagogical approach is you descend on the campus for 2 weeks every 6 months when there are no other students there. So the teachers and the students come from all over the country. You engage in lectures, workshops, classes, readings, And it's incredibly intense. Medical school was good preparation for that, because at the end of the 2 weeks, most people staggered out of there and I was ready for another semester. And indeed, I petitioned to stay on an extra year.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Well, it must have been, you mentioned to me, I believe, that this was one of the most extraordinary experiences of your life. If you wanted to hang on for an extra year, that must have been true. What was it? What was the sort of kernel of extraordinary?
Well, I understand Ann Carson's on the faculty now at Michigan. She was there one semester when I was there. In the audience for any class would be the other teachers, which immediately meant that for a teacher, they didn't just pull a lecture off the shelf. They knew they were doing this to their peers. So the level of dialogue and discourse was very, very high. There would be times there would be three or four MacArthur Award winners in the audience. The students were very diverse and very impressive. And the founder of the program, Ellen Bryant Voigt, I remember telling her that this program would make an incredible New Yorker profile. And she, as was her wont, she said, "That's a great idea. Why don't you write it?" Which immediately stopped me in my tracks. But to give one example, when I was practicing medicine, I was an inner city pediatrician, and I had a lot of African American patients, a lot of teenage mothers, and there was one woman in the class who had I don't think she'd mind me mentioning her on the air—a superb poet whose name, karmically, was Constance Merritt. She subsequently won some book awards. She's had her poetry in the New Yorker and in the Atlantic and places like that. And she had a medical condition, various medical conditions, so she was essentially blind. She could only read by reading with Braille or holding it right up against her eyes. And yet she was getting a PhD in English literature simultaneously with getting the MFA. She was a wonderful poet. We had people there from Hollywood. We had, Vietnam veterans. They always liked to have a doctor or two around. I suspect that was, they thought it was some kind of security.
There's a doctor in the house.
I remember when, to give you another example, a fiction writer came who was, she was from Malaysia. She was fluent in Portuguese, Malay, Mandarin, Chinese, and English. She was an emergency room physician. She taught modern dance. And at the time, she was an illegal alien also.
Heavens to Betsy.
Yeah.
That's a lot of hats and issues and stuff. Well, it sounds like an amazingly diverse program. And I imagine that some of those teachers have been big influences. Who have been the big, if you had to sort of pick a handful of three to five, who would you say, and they don't all have to be poets, but
sure.
Who are your, what's your lineage?
That's another always good for a writer to think about in terms of the immediate lineage, and that was such a seminal event in my life. My first teacher, who I may talk about a little later, Aga Shahid Ali, just to show you how the program works, we sat down and he said, "The beginning of your poems are really weak." And I said, "Okay, let's work on the beginning of my poems." And we did. And I had the good fortune to work with Dean Young, who many writers out there and poets out there would know is a fine poet and considered a surrealist and maybe America's finest. And when I told him I wanted to work with him, he said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, I have a scientific background, and for me, one and one always equals two, and I want it to equal three." And he said, "Or Q." and indeed, I worked with him and had a very productive semester. What I was interested in is how, in highly associative poems, but also in what held them together. So I ended up looking at the various factors within poems that endow it with energy, allow it to widely range, and yet still give a kind of a sense of unity or completion.
And that shows up a lot in this book. There are some just amazing leaps that happen and then spiral back round in to sort of where you started, but not. So we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back. You're listening to The Living Writer Show on WCBN. My name is Ashley David, and my guest today is poet Roy Jacobstein. Good afternoon. Thanks for coming back, or we're back. Thanks for being here. You're listening to The Living Writers Show on WCBN. My name's Ashley David. My guest today is poet Roy Jacobstein, and we're talking about his work and his influences, and more broadly about his life and how that plays into his poetry. You have worked in international development. In fact, in the first conversation we had, we discovered we have a colleague in common in Jakarta, which is a very small world sort of story. So you've worked in, you started out as an inner city pediatrician and then became a public health worker overseas. And are you still working in public health then, in addition to your poetry?
Yes, I guess to continue to wear the multiple hats and see how far a human can extend their body. I live in Chapel Hill, and I am the medical director of a international non-governmental organization that works on women's reproductive health overseas, and that's based in New York City. So I commute from Chapel Hill to New York, and I also work overseas periodically in Africa or Asia, working on not clinical medicine, but health programs, helping our counterpart programs with the latest knowledge and skills about reproductive health.
And being overseas, that brings up all kinds of issues of politics. And another little musical break.
The 21st century intrudes.
It does. Well, it's good to know we're here. We won't lose where we are. This is indeed located in this epoch. So let's think about politics. We'll move off of technology and back to politics, although they're interrelated, particularly in international family planning circles. But a lot of your poems are infused with political threads, and you're writing what you've called to me, what you've termed to me, some political poetry. And I wonder if you'll talk a little bit about what political poetry means to you, what that term means, and what that does. And then we'll read one of your poems. Well, you'll read one of your poems, and,
sure.
And we'll talk some more.
I suppose, in a sense, one could make the case, I've seen it said, and there's a certain truth to it, that all poetry at a certain level is political, if political is taken to mean the choices you make in your life and the implications they have for the world around you. I sense, when I think about it, there's a continuity in the kind of development work I do and in the writing, in that they are both animated, at least in part, by a sense of injustice that I guess I got kind of early on, and I suppose it relates to my ethnic heritage. And there are still a lot of pretty terrible things going on, as we all know. Ironically, when I graduated Warren Wilson, it was June of 2001, and to graduate, you have to give a course, and I gave a course on political poetry, and I was going to initially make the case that because there are so many received truths in political poetry that it's easy to write bad political poetry, like slavery was bad, what we did to the Indians was bad, the Holocaust was bad, and to transcend that and turn it into art it's always difficult to do in any circumstance, but in some ways it's harder to do with political poetry. And I was going to make the case that it had to be held to a higher standard, and then I realized that that was privileging it in the other direction, but it simply has to be excellent. But what I did was, one of the techniques I did was to festoon the wall with quotes from well-known poets. So on the one hand, I recall having Yeats, who said, "I detest the poetry of the point of view," even though you could argue that he wrote some poems like that. And on the other hand, Neruda, who perhaps is the greatest love poet, or one of them, mm-hmm. saying that he thought political poetry was more profound than love poetry, and yet some of his political poetry is not all that good. And I guess poets write in a certain way to say, "I was here," to say, "This is what's important, this is what's important to me." And the political realm, as we see today, if I can make a plug, just by chance, and you don't know this yet, Ashley, I don't think, but just yesterday, the poetry website Poetry Daily, which is www.poems.com, featured one of my poems that is now in the Three Penny Review called Ardor. And on the surface, that poem is about Theodore Roosevelt and how he managed to eliminate the British spelling from the English we use, but it's really a poem about Iraq. So that's an example of how to transmute something and to give it layers of meaning the way poetry does.
Well, and let's look at an example that we have with us today in which you do that, and then we'll talk about some more about some of the ways in which you do. Will you read Stolat for us?
Sure. I have to say, I preface this, this is a long poem I wrote when at the time I was and have continued to be interested in the world and world events and trying the whole area called poetry of witness. This was when I was trying to get every atrocity and terrible thing into a poem before that teacher I mentioned, Aga Shahid Ali, taught me the very useful notion that if you're writing about a big subject, you should write small, and if you're writing about a small subject, you should write big. So this one, I didn't follow that, but it's called Stolat, which in Polish means long life and is the toast to good health, or literally 100 years. And it's written to the memory of Robert Desnos, the French poet. "Your voice comes late, Robert, here in a converted barn at a writer's conference, amid the litany of concentration camps rattling the loose windows, the names of many unknown to me, a child of the mild and mundane Midwest, born after the ovens had cooled, their vapors curling no longer out of Europe's voiceless mouth over the Black Madonna's saltless tears. There were blue numbers on the ventral surface of her right arm, my mother-in-law-to-be, that spring day in 1970. Her daughter Shoshana, the one the few survivors from Rodham said was Manya's exact double, stood beneath the canopy, Detroit Sheret Tzedek, and heard the rabbi say, 'Repeat after me,' in Hebrew and then English, 'Ani ladodi vadodi li,' 'I am my beloved's, as my beloved is mine.' I too was learning new words, lesion, necrosis, dysmorphic, ventral. I pay tribute to you, Manya, Manushka, Maria, grandmother of my son. I thank God you spoke flawlessly that guttural tongue I can never hear without hearing round them up. Spoke so fluently, you and your blue eyes passed, and even when they could pass no longer, still, at Auschwitz, they were passport to the office job, the occasional German kindness of warm roll, a hard-boiled egg, just as there must have been at Auschwitz a sunny day, sunny days, the kind of day where anywhere on earth long life seems possible. I pay tribute to you, Robert, reading the fortunes of your fellow travelers, headed where? Birkenau, Belsen, Treblinka, Terezin. Even in the boxcars, you trailed your index finger along the smooth palms of the young, the creases and fissures of the old, predicting in a low voice over the clacketing rails, in French, your mother tongue, the language of Piaf and Pétain, to one and all, long life. To all those smiling Cambodians, to whom I spoke in stilting Khmer, in the refugee camps at Khao Dang and Nong Khai, and those in the transit camp at Phnom Nikom, the ones whose smile Pol Pot could not efface, behind whose teeth every tongue, every bitten tongue, held its tale of loss, buried in the graceful splay of the dancer's fingers, the artificial fingernails, curved backward, painted gold, the dances for birth, for rebirth, for harvest, tribute. To that one specific woman, her name long flown, who came to the makeshift delivery room, abdomen swollen, well beyond the nine-month gravid girth the obstetrics text told us to expect, and delivered, without anesthesia, without a sound, a boy without a brain, and got up off the table and smiled at me, made the Y of respect, eyes cast down, palms pressed above her bowed head, and, still saying nothing, returned to the straw pallet in the thatched roof tent where her husband and mother and child awaited her, where she'd slept each night the past 2 years. Tribute. It is true, the hacked and mutilated in Kigali, the ethnically cleansed in all the Srebrenicas, those who survived the gulag and those who didn't, the desaparecidos of Santiago and Buenos Aires and the bloody broken wishbone of Central America, those who fell at wounded knee and those who yet stand, the children of the children of the children of the slaves who passed through Gorée Island to become New World dust, the Armenians, Palestinians, Tibetans, Kashmiris, Kurds, all the tongues, all the words. Poetry stops nothing. I don't know when you were born, Robert. You wrote the poem we heard today in 1928, the one where you call out at midnight, call all to you, those lost in the fields, old skeletons, young oaks cut down, scraps of cloth rotting on the ground, hangmen, pilots, bricklayers, architects, assassins, the one you love. Three times you call the one you love. I'd guess you were close to 30 when you wrote it, maybe 29. Born in 1899, 100 years ago. If they found you in some cafe arguing about Wittgenstein or Nietzsche with your friends, if you didn't look like a Jew and none of your neighbors bore you a grudge or coveted your flat or your gooseneck lamp, maybe they didn't find you for a while until 1942 or 43. That would make you my age when you boarded the train. In the grainy, flickering, silent movie of your life, it would be winter, a gray day, raked by wind, your black fedora slung low over your brow. But it wasn't, I can see it, one of those perfect Parisian days, late spring, 11 a.m., the smell of brioche on the cobblestones, the sun bending to kiss the dry earth like a pilgrim first arrived at Mecca. Now we enter the next century, all the future names God alone knows, their names, the towns, the rivers which will run black, God and you, Robert, and the darkmost chamber of every human heart. But you knew all that even as you went up that rough planking into the boxcar and stood with the others massed there, held on to the sideboards with one hand, the other you took from your lower back, where the blunt end of the Pulitzer-sized rifle had smashed into your kidney. Your urine will run red. All this you knew when you ran your finger along the wrinkled right palm of the woman with the gold tooth, looked deep into her deep brown eyes, and predicted long life, and to her 12-year-old grandson clinging to her side, long life. The wheel is turning, Robert. The next century is upon us. The knives are glinting and sharp. The one you loved did not listen. The one you loved did not hear. The one you loved did not answer. I extend my hand to you.
Thank you. We'll be right back after a break, and we'll talk a little bit about that poem. You're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. This is the Living Writers Show. My name is Ashley David. My guest today is Roy Jacobstein, and we're talking about his book, Ripe. Welcome back. This is WCBN. We are speaking with Roy Jacobstein on the Living Writers Show today. The poem you just read for us, Stolat, from your book, Ripe, you wrote that before September 11th, and you actually flew to Cambodia, September 11th, 2001, that would be, 9/11, and you flew to Cambodia right about then. Have I got the dates right?
Yes.
And you spoke about, or you mentioned the term poetry of witness. I'm wondering sort of what the impulses are for you. If you had to kind of get to the core, your impulses in writing political poetry, is this a poetry of witness, or is this a process of working through emotion or tapping into currents that are there about conflict in your own life? Where do you locate the nucleus of your impulse to write poetry that's political?
I don't even know if we have to qualify it as political, because I think there is a kind of... I read once somewhere that having a kind of low-grade but functional degree of melancholy is a good state for a poet. And I remember saying one of the good things about being a poet was that you got to wear black a lot. That was after a fiction writer said, "Boy, you poets sure have a dark view of the world." And I said, "Yeah, but we get to wear black a lot." And then I realized I was in New York, where everybody wears black anyway. You know,
are they all poets or just all melancholy?
But I think, you know, this is obviously just for me, because there are poets that spend Mary Oliver, who writes about nature, and you know, the great poets of love, and I try those things, and sometimes something, what we call a keeper, comes along. But I guess, yeah, the kind of that sense of what is the wrong with the world, or the injustice of the world, is a core part of my psyche and my writing.
In the book, there are lots of threads that come from different places, I imagine, and are point to a rich and varied life. There's also this core of sort of coming from home. You grew up in Detroit or outside Detroit? Mm-hmm.
No, Detroit.
Right, you grew up in Detroit.
The famous Mumford High School.
Oh, did you? Wonderful.
Which you all listeners may have seen in Beverly Hills Cop, because Eddie Murphy wears the sweatshirt from...
Mumford High.
School, yeah.
What's the mascot?
The Mustangs.
The Mumford.
In fact, I won't force the readers to turn the radio off by singing the fight song, but I could.
Well, maybe we'll have you back for that. But I'm wondering if you will tell us a little bit about where you come from originally and how that plays into your poems. And if you'll first read the poem Home Run and then sort of riff off that, I think that's a good place for us to start.
Great. I might say about this poem, one of the no-nos in writing, contemporary writing probably always, has been the avoidance of sentimentality. On the other hand, I forget who said it, but it was very wise that if you're not skirting sentimentality all the time, you won't be writing very meaningful work. So I find myself asking myself which side of the road I'm on with this one, but nonetheless, thank you for asking me to read it. Home Run. Somewhere still, it's salami day, so my father must be slicing and dicing with the precision of a Japanese chef, the chunks of purple meat flecked with fat piling higher and higher on the formica counter in the kitchen. If it's Tuesday, it'll be French fry day. My friends will be hooking their mitts to their jeans, hopping onto their bikes. 6 p.m., he's been sighted again, disgorged from the Dexter Davison bus. His briefcase moves in pace with his stride up the street toward our first floor flat. They can see the tie already loosened at his neck, the sleeves of his white-on-white shirt rolled back, bearing the lipomas that line the length of his dark forearms like eroded hills. They can already hear his chortle, can imagine the gurgle of hot oil surging through the mesh strainer. Already they're burning the roofs of their mouths, they'll never learn, and the golden hand-hewn fries, edges beveled like cut gems, always taste like luck. Sweat pearls on his scalp, a windshield's first drops of rain, wiped away, returning. It's the sweat of running the bases, the ball rolling between left and center all the way to the fence. It's the good sweat of a good man, my father, headed home.
Thank you. So you grew up in Detroit, went to Mumford High School. Talk a little bit about, I mean, the poem tells us a little bit perhaps about the sort of atmosphere there, although I won't hazard to say this is autobiographical. Yeah. But what is your experience like in retrospect now that you are sort of a citizen of the world?
Well, sometimes I am fond of thinking of all the people who have come from Detroit to Madonna, I could go on and on. But it's funny because one of the talks I'm giving here during the 3 days that I'm visiting lecturer in the medical humanities is I'm talking about why it took me so long to come to writing. And one of them, one of the etiological causes I attribute to Vlad the Impaler, the original of whom was, of course, Dracula, but in my case, it was Vladimir Nabokov, and I thought that I had to write like him in three languages, never revising anything, as he claimed he never did, which I subsequently found was, of course, totally false. And then he had a magical, charmed childhood in the midst of the Russian Revolution and on the French Riviera, and I used to feel sorry for myself. I was growing up in Detroit. Well, you know, who's going to be able to write about that? And yet, as I just found myself feeling as I was reading that poem, and for those of you who've read the wonderful Detroit novel Middlesex, or the poetry of Philip Levine and many other writers and poets, Detroit, like any other place, home is a rich load to draw from. And it doesn't have to be the Riviera to be a source for you. And you can make it your Riviera or your Russian Revolution or whatever.
And in thinking about sort of subject and drawing from places, how do you anchor yourself? I mean, you now live in Chapel Hill, work in New York and around the world. You're on tours, as with this one. You're in the air a lot, and is Detroit an anchor? Is home is a concept of home different from Detroit, and what would that be?
I think, in a way, much like novelists say that you know they have to write their first coming of age novel or their first divorce novel, I can see now that at least for me, my first book of poetry was a Detroit novel, a Detroit book of poetry as well. For anybody who reads it, I thought I had left internship and residency behind, although I often describe internship and residency to non-medical friends as the closest that a kind of middle-class, well-fed American can come to being in the gulag. So I suppose it's not surprising that both of those were sources of my first book. One would be able to tell. I have two more books that I have been they've been finalists in book contests. They haven't yet been accepted anywhere, but they certainly you could tell it was the same writer and have a lot of the same themes, but Detroit is much less prominent. Medicine is still there because any specialized pursuit gives you a diction, a specialized diction that is very useful in poetry. The more things you can bring to poetry, whether it's syntax, diction, there's a whole host of tools you can bring to your poems, and certainly diction of a specialized sort is one.
So let's talk about the new books. You're going to be reading, this is a pre-recorded broadcast, but you will have read, by the time folks are listening to this, you will have read at Shaman Drum from your book Tourniquet. Am I right?
I have a chapbook that's now out called Tourniquet. That title poem details in great and painful length my mortifying performance on the game show Jeopardy. It manages to include love, death, and taxes in the same poem.
And Jeopardy.
It has poems that come from my second book called A Form of Optimism and my third book called If They Don't Have Ritalin in Heaven. If They Don't Have Ritalin in Heaven is a poem that will shortly be out in the Gettysburg Review, and A Form of Optimism takes its title from this saying. You'll see it's continuing the interest in political poetry. It's taking its title from a saying of Roberto Rossellini in Cahiers du Cinéma in 1954. He said, I am not a pessimist. To look evil in the face is a form of optimism. So that book has more, like the poem that I mentioned that's on Poetry Daily yesterday, Monday, September 26th, is in that book. Tourniquet, the poem about Jeopardy and more popular culture kinds of poems, are in the third book. And I even have a fourth one that is not, it's not ready to be sent out, but it's called Fuchsia in Cambodia, and it's about adopting my little daughter. My wife and I found ourselves in Cambodia on September 11th, 2001, which is 12 hours ahead of time, so it wasn't our September 11th yet. And I woke up the next morning to tell a friend of mine who was working there that we were going to get her. And he said, what do you think about everything? And I said, what? And he said, turn on the TV. And then in 50 channels and how many languages, countless languages, there were the towers falling down. And then we went to get our little daughter, who I think of as the little yes in the face of the great no's.
Well, and a lot of your poetry in the book that I've read in Ripe does look for the yes in the face of many no's. As you're going forward, a lot of poets these days are working and writing from the academy. You're working and writing from outside the academy. How do you see your relationship to the academy? Well, you're here now. You're here at the University of Michigan giving some talks and doing some roundtables and giving this interview. How do you see your relationship to the academy and
Well, it's there's been an interesting shift in American poetry. In the first half of the century, most poets were outside of the academy. So famously, William Carlos Williams was a pediatrician like myself. Wallace Stevens was a lawyer and an insurance agent. T.S. Eliot was a bank clerk. And then in poetry, for better or for worse, and I could argue either way, but I think largely for better, because at least it's keeping it alive, is in the academy. But that means that somebody who is outside of that tends not to be in the mainstream, and not so much aesthetically, but in terms of being known. At Warren Wilson, I had friends who came out of a legal background or a healthcare background, and so we bring different things to it, but you're not, you don't feel like you're kind of with the group, which can be a little lonely sometimes.
Great. Well, we are about out of time, so we'll wrap up the show today. I want to thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to The Living Writers Show on WCBN. My guest has been Roy Jacobstein, and we've been talking about his book, Ripe, and about his writing and process of writing and his life generally. A special thank you to our engineer, Chaz Barrett. Please stay tuned for the sports show, which comes up next. And a reminder that this show has been pre-recorded for broadcast today. It was pre-recorded on September 27th. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.